Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Leo Laporte, episode 52 for January 17th, 2009. Casey Reese and Ben Fry on processing.org. This show is brought to you by listeners like you and your contributions. We couldn't do it without you. Thanks so much. It's time for Floss Weekly, a look at free Libre open source software, all the good stuff. This is the good stuff. And joining us right now from, are you in Oregon?
I am in Portland, Oregon. It's true, or nearby anyway.
You never know. Randall Schwartz, he's a world traveler.
Indeed, a world traveler. I mean, our show 3 or 4 weeks from now might actually have to come from Australia, so we'll see how that works.
We'll find out more about that in a little bit. Who are we going to be talking to today?
Wow, this show is going to be interesting. Of course, I say that every week now, because in fact, we do have interesting guests every week. Yep. I've been trying to get these guys lined up for quite a while, finally managed to get the slot worked out. This is Ben Fry and Casey Reese, who work for the, or at least met at the MIT Media Lab. And while they were there, they worked on a way of writing easy software to visualize data. And they called it processing. It was originally called a couple of other things till it got to the word processing, but that's what it's called now. And they are going to be speaking to us about this programming language and user interface, I guess, that allows you to visualize data and write algorithms that can be that manage, you know, movement of things on the screen and all sorts of things like that.
Wow, that sounds very cool. Mm-hmm. Before we call Ben and Casey, the Affleck brothers, before we call...
Not the Afflecks.
Before we call Ben and Casey, not the Affleck brothers, how's your arm feeling? You're feeling better?
Oh, man. You know, I've still been in physical therapy twice a week, but we actually had a breakthrough on Monday. For one, finally, I could get my entire hand closed. I can actually touch the tips of my fingers to the base of my thumb, and that was a huge breakthrough. So as we were exploring what that meant in terms of my progress... The physical therapist started doing some deep tissue work on my arm, actually working really deep and wrenching in it, because this is about the earliest that she's been able to sort of really push in on it without triggering a lot of really bad feelings. Ow. Except she got to one of the little bones in my wrist. I believe it's called the lunate bone. It's a very tiny one, looks like a little moon. And whenever she touched it, it was extremely sensitive. Now, nothing at 8 or 10 weeks away from surgery should be that sensitive. And so there's actually this theory going around, we're actually checking with the doctor now, that I may have a couple of my bones sort of not coming loose when they should, which is why I've had not very much progress in getting my bones turned around again.
They're knitted.
Yeah, so, but that's good that we discovered that now, because I mean, I just kept saying, I'm doing the exercise, but I still can't turn my hand past thumb up. In other words, if you hold out your left hand, I can point my thumb to the right, and I can point it all the way up, but I can't turn it to the left. At all. I mean, it's only straight up right now, and that's just really annoying. And part of that is because if the bone that little teeny lunate bone is next to, and I forget what it's called, triceratops or something, I don't know. Anyway, those two bones, if they aren't releasing from each other or rotating around each other, that would be exactly the symptom. And so this could be a good breakthrough to figure out what's going on, and maybe just some scar tissue if they go into some ultrasound or something. And hopefully, God, I hope it doesn't mean another surgery. But anyway, I'm feeling less hurt. Things are a little bit better. Thank you for asking once again. And I'm hoping, you know, I'm going on another Insight cruise in another 6 weeks. And I'm hoping to be able to take my 40D along with me again, because I'd like to be able to use the focus ring. I mean, that would be handy.
Hey, you might be all better by then. Let's look on the bright side.
I'm hoping so. Yes, definitely.
So coming up, we're going to talk to Casey Reese and Ben Fry. Mm-hmm. They met as students in the very famous MIT Media Lab. Mm-hmm. They're experts on the visual presentation of information. In fact, they wrote a book. One of them wrote a book called Visualizing Data, I guess Ben did, for O'Reilly. He's mm-hmm. a designer in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Casey, it's kind of interesting. He is the an assistant professor of and the chairman of the Department of Design Media Arts at the University of California, Los Angeles. So really some people with some very interesting pedigrees, very interesting backgrounds.
You know who else?
Professional computer scientists.
Yeah. Who else came out of MIT Media Lab?
Have also are professional artists.
Yeah.
I think it's an interesting mix.
MIT Media Lab, also the source of Richard Stallman.
You say Ben and Casey.
So let's get Ben Fry and Casey Rees on the line. Hello, guys.
Hey, hey, Randall.
So I guess we're talking to you guys today about the processing language. Can one of you give us a short description of what that's about?
Sure. Processing is a programming language based on Java, and it's really built for designers and artists as a way of approaching programming. I think programming education usually starts with a Hello World program, text-based programming, and processing puts the focus entirely on graphics. It allows people to start off very simply, for example, typing in line and a few coordinates and then hitting run and displaying the image on screen. But it also allows you to write complicated and object-oriented programming. So it really extends very far. So it's easy to learn, but you can build involved projects with it as well.
You don't often think of computer scientists and artists in the same breath. If you were thinking in breaths,
the two have been together for really since the origin of things.
Really?
Oh, of course. I think early software experiments were doing graphics. They were doing graphics at Bell Lab back in the beginning. Places like Bell Labs had artists on staff. They've been working with the computer science engineers and developing graphics applications. It's a niche, and more and more artists and designers are starting to become programmers. I mean, their primary work is in doing their visual projects, but they do that through writing very sophisticated programs.
So the target for this would be an artist who wants to express themselves, and I presume it's primarily visually, and in a way that, but they're going to have to be interacting with some programming language, and this is what processing is, yes?
Exactly, yes.
I think
the focus is even more so the design community, too.
Ben, your background initially was in visualization of data, which I could, I could see more as a computer science thing.
Sure.
But you also are a fine artist. So how do they relate?
So both Casey and I have backgrounds in both design as well as computer science. And we kind of forked off of that. You know, we wound up at this lab at MIT because we could join this group where everyone had some sort of background in some kind of visual arts plus some type of engineering or computer science or something like that. So for myself, I'm interested in the visualization side of it. You know, so it's as a designer, what can I do with very large data sets? And that, you know, in by actually being able to work in code, that completely changes the amount of things that I can look at, the type of thing I can look at. You know, I can deal with data that's changing all the time, data that's very large, you know, that type of thing.
What is the work that you show, the fine art pieces? What do they look like? Do they look like visualizations of data, or
for myself or for Casey?
Yeah, we can start, Ben.
In my case, what I typically try and do, I try and work on sort of a range between something that's purely towards the fine arts end of things and other things that are much more tool oriented. And I think it's actually really nice to kind of work back and forth between the two. One of the interesting things is that, and the reason that I kind of got into more of the fine arts side of it was that people started picking up the projects as actual artworks, or sort of looking at them as artworks, as opposed to, these were sort of research experiments that I had done to kind of work out a visualization idea. And so as people began to respond to that more, I found that, you know, fairly interesting as it, another thing to pursue. And then I was invited to do, you know, different shows or show work at different places.
Casey's the chair of the Design and Media Arts Department at UCLA. But you're also a fine artist too, right, Casey?
Yes. Well, like many people, I wear many hats.
Right.
But I show my work in galleries extensively, yes.
And is computation part of your art as well?
It's really all of the work. I think it's some artists work in video, some artists work as painters, some artists work with physical materials. We call them sculptors. Software is just another medium to work with. And you can express yourself, you can communicate through software the same way that you can through these more traditional media.
You're kind of blowing my mind. I mean, I always thought of writing software as a creative act, don't get me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But I never thought of it as an art, as a fine art.
Well, it's the result of the software,
right? The output
that is the work, and right. And my work and Ben's work and processing, it really is focused on the image, focused on visuals.
Can I relate it back to something that maybe some of us are familiar with? Well, older people in the audience will be familiar with is that's the old Spirograph.
Yeah.
The Spirograph was great because it was mathematics behind it. But, you know, with the right selection of the right color pens and the right ratio of inner wheel to outer wheel, you could create some really stunning creations. And what you're talking about with processing is sort of that souped up to the, you know, six or seven orders of magnitude, right?
Yeah. So as soon as you can start talking about distributed systems and things. So, Casey, you might want to talk a little bit about what types of things you do in your work as far as emergent work based on, you know, different properties of elements and things like that.
Sure. There are things you can do in software that it enables that, you know, other more traditional visual media doesn't really allow you to do. So my work is all built on emergence. So distributed systems, agent-based software work where the images and the forms actually grow, you know, following the rules of the program. A lot of, you know, like the Kevin Kelly writing, derivative of that.
Would this be something like when they first discovered fractals in the Mandelbrot set, how the beautiful images resulting from the Mandelbrot set that really were completely defined by a simple mathematic formula, but you could actually create something that looked organic as a result. Is that what you're talking about emergent?
Sure. But also emergence are, you know, more like how, a good example, how bird flocks, you know, originate through each bird is following a few basic rules. And then the sort of the structure of the flock emerges from each one following their own pattern. There's no leader bird who instructs each bird to go to their own place. So in following through a software, you get images that have a very organic feel, but at the same time, they're built from these very simple mechanisms.
So you have they're rules based, they're seeded, but then give you surprising results.
Exactly. Yes.
How fun.
So would something like bird flocking be simple to set up with processing?
Yes. I mean, the bird flocking algorithm, the Boyds program by Craig Reynolds, kind of the foundation of that, has been implemented many times in processing. And a lot of artists, for example, Robert Hodgen, has done some extraordinary visual work for, you know, broadcast television, where he's using these flocking algorithms to create these stunning images.
So that would be movies instead. So this is both for stills and movies then.
Well, it is, but I mean, it's about writing the software. And then you can either export the software as an executable that, you know, runs live on someone's computer, or you can export still images from the software, or you can export movies from the software. So it's really, processing is a bit like a Swiss Army knife. You write code with it, you sketch code, you program, but then you can export to many different media. For example, you can also export to PDF files, so you can get these really high resolution vector art too.
Sounds a little bit like Pavre in some ways. We talked to them a couple of weeks ago.
That they're something of a sister community or a, you know, a kindred spirit as far as the types of things that they're doing.
Uh-huh. So is processing kind of a traditional kind of state language compiled and, you know, procedural, or what is it? What does it look like? What is it like? What is it based on?
It's Java with a number of the layers sort of taken off of it. You know, so if you are developing within the processing environment itself, that they take, you know, basically we want to keep around the aspects that we like, but remove some of the things like some of the more pedantic bits of, you know, I don't want to teach object oriented programming just in order to get, you know, to teach a student how to get a line to show up on the screen.
Right.
And so we do some things like that to kind of clean the syntax up a bit. But fundamentally, it's, you know, sort of Java based. And, you know, more recently, we've had a lot of people who have taken that then to even into other languages. So looking at, you know, Ruby and Python and a JavaScript version and, you know, things like that.
And yet you felt that you needed a dedicated language to do this.
Yeah, because there was sort of a, you know, two parallel tracks. And one is that we were trying to teach other people how to do the type of work that we were doing back at MIT. You know, so we saw a lot of, you know, overlap between that and the way that we actually would sort of sketch with our own projects that at the time, you know, so late 90s, early 2000, 2001, we would write code in Java to kind of work out an idea, and then we would port it over to C++ and OpenGL, you know, to run on SGI workstations so that it could actually run quickly enough, and you know, we could go from there. And then basically we saw this connection between what we were doing there and also the way that we tried to, you know, teach about how this stuff worked. And so, you know, the same types of things we wanted to make simple for people just getting started also were the same types of things. You know, we didn't want to deal with setting up animation loops and threads and dealing with file IO and all this other sort of plumbing, all these plumbing activities that you have to get into just to get, you know, some code up and running. And so we wanted to hide that stuff to, you know, sort of save ourselves the RSI and, you know, hide it from the beginning users just because, you know, it wasn't a useful part of, you know, what they were learning about programming.
Randall, it almost sounds like something Squeak would be really...
I imagine there's probably similar systems in Smalltalk too, and in probably Self and things like that.
Right, right, right.
Yeah, and it's really not fair to say it's an entirely different language. It's really more of a dialect, I would say. But I mean, all of the control structures are the same as in Java. You create arrays and classes exactly the same as in Java. So really, what we've done is we've integrated a graphics library totally into the language, and added a few things that are specific for working with color, for working with shapes that don't come as a part of Java.
So is it translated to Java source code first, or translated to Java bytecodes, or how is it actually processed?
It's translated over to Java source code, and then we'd run it through the regular Java compiler and, you know, debug it using the bytecode interpreter and things like that.
So could I take this code and embed it in some larger application then?
Yeah, so we can do that type of thing. We have a handful of projects that do that. Some of my own work, you know, so doing the visualization side, I'll often embed it into a larger Java-based project. But, you know, it's really sort of what can we do even before we start architecting out the entire, you know, an entire system or a full-blown software package. That how do we just get started making something and getting something to show up on screen very quickly?
Right. I played with it a little bit, and my impression of it is that I start something and I've got this interactive window where I can say, create a square, color it red, and I immediately get to see that happen. And that was really rewarding for me to immediately do that. And so that's sort of the way everybody sort of initially approaches it. Then they're doing this sort of interactive mode, but then going on to edit files and compile them in and things like that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, so with the hope of basically this is kind of your gateway drug to ever more complicated, you know, programming languages. And, you know, we've ruined a lot of careers of, you know, perfectly good designers who are now writing code and, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah. And there isn't, now let's make this clear, there's really no... All right, and you're going to hate me for saying this. Practical practical application for this. This is purely artistic.
A lot of people use it for doing work they're paid for, and it actually has an extremely strong educational component to it. Oh. That was one of the primary audiences of the program, was for teaching within the context of art and design schools. As you know, programming is always kind of been relegated to the sciences, the engineering parts of campus, and we're working with a lot of other people to build a programming culture unique to the arts. So with a lot of people do work, they're commissioned to do work with processing, and also through the education, it's a very pragmatic project, I think.
Do you think that the idea of using computers in art, I'm sure some of the art establishment goes, yeah, right. But, I mean, it's fairly new, modern. Yes.
Well, yes.
It's like any other, but it sort of takes the trajectory of any other art medium, though. You know, that they felt the same way about film. They felt the same way about photography.
Sure.
You know, so we're still at a stage right now where, you know, a lot of times the interactive works or sort of computational pieces are still in kind of a sort of ghetto at larger museums. Though even just in the last, you know, 8 to 10 years of Casey and I since grad school, that's actually, you know, changed quite a bit, even just in that space of time.
It is a little bit of a hybrid, though. I mean, at Media Lab, everybody loves Media Lab, and it's very, I mean, it's, there's, and the, and I was looking at some of the works at processing.org. They're really interesting. They're gorgeous. They're fascinating. I love the emergence stuff. And so it's very appealing to people. I think people probably get it right away. I'm just,
yeah. And another audience for the project, which is almost as large as the audience we've been talking about, are people who are professional programmers, or people who are researchers, or people who are statisticians who need to visualize things simply, and they already know how to program. They're experts in C++ or Java programming, and processing allows them a way of making these visual projects quickly and simply.
So let's take a simple application of that I can actually relate to. Many, many years ago, I worked for a company that was trying to put 66 satellites in orbit to do cell phone communications. I won't mention the name. But one of the things that we had to do was take the data that simulated a day's traffic going up and down to the satellites and put them into some sort of great animations that we kind of visualize the traffic over a typical workday. And I know that we brought in specialists to do that because the code was lengthy and annoying and huge to be able to do that. And we had to bring in. So I'm thinking that with something like processing, if I was one of the microwave engineers, I could still get a lot of it done because it's all simplified.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. And that, you know, the difference being that with processing, we have, you know, right at the surface, things like, okay, so you need, you're probably going to want to do 3D. I actually want to see something about where the satellites are. You want a little mm-hmm. bit of interaction. So we're going to have the mouse input right there.
Yeah, yeah.
You're going to be able to feed this off the web. So we're going to be able to, you know, just read data, you know, stream it directly off of a socket connection and basically bundle all of that together and, you know, kind of do that in, you know, just a couple pages of code instead of kind of starting out by, well, I'm going to architect out this, you know, big satellite tracking application. And, you know, what set of middleware do I need? And, you know, all these other layers that instead, how do we, you know, do that kind of stuff that, you know, for instance, in my own work, I've done a lot of work looking at genetic data and visualizing genetic data. So and I, you know, my postdoctorate work was at a genetics lab at MIT and Harvard. And, you know, so the thing we would do there is actually visualizing the genome, you know, so how do you browse the human genome and or based on, you know, things that we would find, how do you build methods of, you know, visualizing that? And so particularly in that kind of context, the speed with which you can do things is much more important. You know, so if I want to be able to build something 1 week that I can throw away the next week or the week after that, that it's more important to me to be able to, like, you know, kind of take a data set and do something with it and understand what's in it and then, you know, move on to the next step. So really kind of borrowing from the scripting community, for instance, on that side of it.
Well, I'm thinking one area would be really cool for this would be like a network operations center, because I know that they have to take a ton of raw data and visualize it and put it up in mm-hmm. nice displays, filling a wall full of, you know, here's packets and bytes and stuff. And, you Absolutely. Know, the nice thing about NOCs is like they change day by day because somebody's always putting new equipment in or a new line in, and then you got to have new visuals for that. Mm-hmm. And that's a
yes.
constant chasing problem. I relate to it as this admin that this is really an issue that's important. So mm-hmm. something like mm-hmm. Processing might be good for that sort of interaction.
Well, and Ben, you worked on graphics for Minority Report. I mean, that's all that was, right?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's just, you know, ways of showing information.
Yeah. So it's, you know, the thing that's interesting about Finland movie stuff is kind of, you know, planning things in people's heads, you know, so it's like, well, this is what computers look like in 20 or 30 years or,
right.
you know,
right.
You know, so that type of work is kind of fun in that respect.
And but at the same time, I don't want to say it has to have any pragmatic application. I mean, art is mm-hmm. art. It doesn't, you know, you don't have to justify it by saying, well, look, it's going to be useful. It's also very beautiful and very interesting and thought provoking.
Yeah. And I think the people who are using it have very different types of goals that, you know, range from the artistic side to the pragmatic side to, I think, for instance, the work that's highlighted in the site on processing.org leans much closer to the art and design side, because mm-hmm. that's sort of, you know, where we've come from. And, you know, to be honest, we probably haven't done as good a job of actually building a community around the people who are, you know, doing, who are actually in, you know, in their offices, building things on deadline, you know, that kind of thing, around these projects, at least on the more engineering side. So
Some of these are applications, too. In fact, if you go to processing.org, you can run some of these on the web. So you can actually experiment it with processing yourself, the source code, and see what the result is.
Yeah, there's some online examples there. I was just going through those earlier.
They're pretty so cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one thing that was really important in the design of the project from the very beginning. We've been doing it since 2001 now, was that when people make projects, they post them online, they share them with other people, they put their code there. I mean, that was largely just, you know, from my experience working in the web industry, doing Vue Source back in the mid-90s, and that's how we would learn everything.
Right.
And it's also core to the core of open source, too.
Sure.
Just wanted to kind of build the community as a group rather than individuals hoarding their own knowledge, of, you know, techniques about how to work with the graphics.
A lot of this stuff is being done in Flash now. I mean, people are kind of ad hoc doing this kind of work. Is processing easier to work in?
It's different. It really just depends on what kind of work you want to do.
Right.
You know, Ben says a lot, you know, if you're doing a drawing, sometimes you may want to use a pencil, sometimes a pen. It just depends. One's not necessarily inherently better than the other.
Right.
Flash has its strengths. Processing has its strengths.
Right. Mm. This is really, it's really some cool stuff. I have to say, I'm having fun playing with the various applications that are.
Leo, I'm surprised based on past shows that you haven't downloaded the actual
started coding.
Yes. Usually does this.
Are a lot of people working at students, or do you have actually working artists using it too?
Both, really. A lot of students then become working artists and use it later at that point.
Right.
We do know that I think it is used extensively in universities. As we track the numbers of how many people are using it, they kind of rise and fall with the beginning and end of semesters. And I think, interestingly, it's being used at all kinds of institutions, from universities to art schools to high schools, and then also used in, you know, intro to computer science classes, where before you would be learning straight Java or something like that. Now people are starting to experiment with introducing processing at that stage.
I think a good idea, because you get instant feedback, instant results. It's like Turtle Graphics and some of the
Turtle Graphics and Logo was a huge inspiration. I mean, I think for both of our lives in computing and thinking about software, for sure.
Interesting. Yeah.
And even things like just the, you know, simpler languages like BASIC, you know, so we grew up with Apple IIs. And so the idea that you flip the machine on, you can start writing a little bit of basic code, that, you know, that the idea that that should just kind of work,
right,
you know, was a huge influence.
Right.
Yeah, I remember that from the old Atari 800 days, in fact, being able to say move 2, 1, 1, draw 2, 10, 10, and just having a line immediately show up. And and then I said, well, what if the endpoint is slightly random?
Right.
And I started drawing these random things all over the screen. And you're right, there is something very interesting about the what happens as a result of then going, well, maybe a kind of random will do more than what I want to do. And you start getting, you know, random walks that only curve slightly. So now you've got graceful curves on. And I'm sure if I had another 2 hours a day, I'd be playing with this for an hour and a half of that already. I can already see that.
Yeah, I think it's really through playing with the software, you know, through modifying samples, through looking at code and testing things out, that's really when active learning happens, I think. And so we're really just trying to make it more accessible for people who think visually.
Yeah, very important.
And it's certainly how Casey and I both learn programming as well, that, you know, we benefited greatly from looking at other people's code and just, you know, sort of working it out ourselves, and then later did some more formal training and things. But
now this thing looks mostly visual, but is there audio as well?
Yeah, there is. There's actually one thing we haven't talked about is our the library system that we have set up. So libraries or extensions, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
The primary way the project is growing is through user contributions, where people, they want the project to do something that it doesn't inherently do. They write a library of code that docks into the main project and extends it. So we have, I think, 5 different sound libraries now that people have contributed to the project. And they do everything from MIDI playback to sample playback to audio synthesis. It's really growing in these different ways over time. It's really extraordinary.
Have people made installations as well with this? I'm looking at one right now, actually. There's a movie on the website.
Yeah, people have done, you know, computer vision projection installations that take up large rooms. Mm-hmm. many different ways you can dock into the graphics with different kinds of inputs and outputs.
Right.
Wow. So is this something that, who would be like the person who this wouldn't be for? I mean, you need to have some programming skill. You need to be able to understand what a variable is and things like that, right?
Actually, we teach that through processing. And we have, we published a book in fall 2007 that kind of is a comprehensive introduction to computer programming through the processing language. And there's been two others that do the same thing. And so we try and encourage people to learn programming through this environment, but also if people do already understand how variables work, how functions work, they can just dive in and start finding the way through.
Wow. Yeah. Cause I know that, some of the things that's hard to teach in programming is, you know, what's really happening. If you're just writing a program and printing the number 10 at the end, it really isn't exciting to most people.
Yeah. So instead of doing like a println with a 10, we watch a line move from left to right across the screen. You learn the same thing, but for people who are visually motivated or for a more general audience, it's just a different way of understanding it.
There you go, Leo, for Henry again.
Yeah, no kidding. I'm always looking for stuff for him to use. But, you know, look, he loves playing an instrument, for instance, and that's because there's instant feedback. Mm-hmm. And programming is so abstract, I think anything that can make it give you feedback and make it more concrete is a valuable thing for teaching, especially for younger kids.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think absolutely.
Could he create something that would take audio input, like from the music he's playing, and draw visuals based on that?
Absolutely. That's a really common thing that a lot of my undergraduate students want to do, and they do it.
There you go, Leo.
Students at a younger age could easily do it.
All right.
Processing. So go to processing.org. It's free. You can download it. While you're there, take a look at all the different projects that I was looking at the Emergence project. It was a really interesting installation. Was that in L.A.?
I don't know which one you're referring to,
They have video of it, and the bus is going. Oh, it's in Chicago. That's very cool. It's very cool. Processing.org.
What license is this?
It is LGPL for the actual binaries that are included with the code, and GPL for the environment itself.
Okay, cool. That's pretty broad. And what do you use to develop it? Obviously, you're developing in Java, so using like Eclipse and stuff.
We're slowly transitioning into Eclipse. It had been Emacs and a bunch of Emacs and duct tape and bubble gum and like an old pair of shoes running in the command line prior. So,
small community, large community, and how do you manage it?
Working on the core, it's a very small community, but it's the library community that's the very large one that sort of a great number of people who kind of carve out their own niche. And there's these sort of, you know, little 1 to 3 person projects that kind of pop up and they, you know, solve a particular thing that they want to do and they post that up online. And then hopefully they post the code and somebody else comes along later and kind of builds that on, you know, a little bit more and, you know, things kind of progress that way.
And you coordinate that with dev mailing lists then?
Yeah, both. We have a discussion board and then we do some mailing list stuff when we have a very specific goal. Like we had a processing 1.0 release. So we pulled in, you know, a dozen or so people who are more directly involved in using it or working on it, you know, just as a way to kind of put that release out, for instance.
I notice you also have interfaces to hardware like the Arduino.
Arduino is very much of a sister project to this. It actually, the language that you use for programming Arduino directly came out of processing. I was teaching at the same institution that Arduino came out of.
Arduino is kind of a interface board, a robot, mostly used for robotics, or
really more just for hacking around with hardware.
Yeah, any kind of hardware. Okay,
exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So you could write interface for it in processing.
There's actually a really nice library called Arduino for processing.
Oh, cool.
That allows you to directly control the board. So you can directly get feedback or directly get the pin values off the board and directly put voltages onto the pins of the board through the processing code. Or you can talk over serial. It's really easy both ways.
Yeah, we've got the Arduino folks on a potential show coming up soon.
Oh, good.
So it'd be great if we can relate this to that. They're cool.
Fantastic. Yeah, they're good friends.
It's a sign of the maturity of I think computing and processing that it's it is being used in all sorts of creative ways, as well as just simple, prosaic solving a solution, finally solving a problem. And I think it's very exciting. I mean, it is kind of, it is science fiction. It is very modern to think of letting these machines do other stuff besides just one plus one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's computing is, it's fastly entering social context and cultural context.
Right.
It's becoming a more broad initiative. It's fantastic.
Well, and we see that, of course, with social media and so forth, and the internet has made a big difference. But I love it right to the metal doing this kind of stuff with computing power. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of, if you want to go to the processing page, there's also a link to YouTube videos and Vimeo videos of projects. I'm showing one from YouTube right now that is just, it's just stunning. I mean, it's just really, and this is that emergent stuff that you're talking about where you set some rules and you let it kind of go. I presume.
It is.
Yeah.
I believe so.
Yeah, it's very cool.
Amazing. Cool stuff.
Well, thank you for joining us, Ben and Casey. I really thank you for your time.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Easy enough to get involved. Go to processing.org and download Processing 1.0. Runs on, I would imagine, because it's Java-based, runs on anything. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Great. Yep. Thank you, guys.
Okay, thank you.
Take care, Ben. Take care, and thanks for joining us, Casey. This is cool.
Yeah,
that's, I want to start writing some stuff.
Well, you know, I know I keep bringing you all these things that are great to play with, but that's because that's the kind of stuff I like to look at too. So, you know, it's kind of a works that way. And again,
when you get into programming, I'm sure this is the case. It was play for you. It has to be play, right?
Yeah, except, you know, for me, text is play. So, but it took a while until I started seeing. Well, I tell you, the problem is that I started programming before there were cheap graphics.
Right.
And so my bias
this has
still
changed
is
everything. Yeah.
Yeah, and I wasn't kidding. When I had my Atari 800, the first thing I started doing was writing random scribbles on the screen.
Right.
And I started just doing deliberate numbers, and I'd say, well, no, what if I make this rand of a number from 1 to 5 plus 10?
Right.
And then it would sort of draw lines from one to the other, and they would wiggle in real time, and I'd go, oh, this is so cool.
I wonder how much more sophisticated this is than that. I mean, I love the idea of setting rules, getting a starting point, and then just seeing what the computer does with it. It's kind of like Conway's Life and the virtual life simulators that we talked about a few weeks ago.
Yeah, well, I looked at some of the code there. I was pawing through the examples in the documentation, and it's kind of about in the middle. In other words, you can get to the low level stuff like, you know, start at 1-1, draw to 10-10, but you can also build up objects, and there are object libraries that say this is a cube in 3 space or this is a torus. And so it will know how to draw itself in 3 space and 3 dimensions and use the OpenGL graphics, so it's very fast on computers that have modern hardware and stuff. So it looks like it's sort of, you know, it's not so high that you just, you know, speak into the machine and go, computer, I want a, you know, but it's not so low that you're going, oh, how do I draw a circle again? You know, it's somewhere in the middle. It sort of feels like somewhere in the middle, which is about where you want to have it for artistic control and for just being that kind of dynamic stuff. So that should be pretty cool.
Very neat.
Yeah, so I'm excited. I'm going to, you know, like I said, when I was researching the show, I downloaded this thing, started playing with it. I went, oh, no, I have to set this aside.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, it will take the rest of my time.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, it's another place where open source software is being used to bring together two groups of people, artists and programmers, and making them one, and in that sense, to be able to have artists have programming capabilities and programmers that have display data without having to reinvent the wheel. They can just download this code from the MIT Media Lab and go to it, and that's really cool. This is why open source software is just such a valuable thing in our society now.
Absolutely. Yeah, you wouldn't do this. I guess you could do it in commercial software, but...
But then, you know, would you... So let's say, you know, you want to give something to Henry to play with, right? Would you pay $149 for this to be commercial software?
No,
because he would play with it for an hour and go, go back to play it. Yeah.
But
you know, if you can download it and play with it for free and he doesn't like it, then there's no risk. It's just a done thing, you know? Or you can mix it in with other things. You can open it up and hook it up with other things. Like the Arduino people, you know, being able to go across that way. That's just incredible. Good stuff.
Yeah, really neat stuff. And kind of silly sometimes and kind of fun. And here's something, Hulk versus Batman, that's done I guess it's done in processing. I don't know. So what are you doing? What are we doing next?
We've got a lot of great guests coming up. And in fact, I added a couple more since our last show. But we've got next week, we do have Chuck Sapersky, and I'm mispronouncing his name, I'm sorry, Zhang Zhang, talking about the fog cloning system to ghost your disk for free, and lots of variations of that as well. The week after that, we have Quim Gill talking to us from Nokia about MAMO, the tablet OS. We've got John Rezik of the jQuery JavaScript Library.
They just updated.
Coming out.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. We've got David Gisnell and Quentin Matthew talking to us about Etoile, which is the OS X-like layer sitting on top of OpenStep. We have a couple of guys from the XBMC project talking about their player that plays every single media known to man. We've got Aaron Newcomb, who I found out is actually an open source podcaster himself. He does a video podcast on open source software. He's works for Sun now, and he's with David Brittle, and they're going to talk about ZFS for us, which should be a pretty nice little thing.
That'll be very interesting, yeah.
And I just added Isaac Clarencia, who is going to be talking about Ebox, which is a turnkey web hosting and system allocating solution, all open source, all written in Perl, 500,000 lines of Perl. So I had to have some Perl coming
half
in.
Half a million lines of Perl. That's there's somebody went crazy.
But this is a, this is an open source provisioning system. So let's say you went and rented, you know, 20 racks worth of hardware somewhere. You have 20 racks and you wanted to resell those services to your friends or whatever. This is the kind of software that can manage that stuff, deploy a Linux box at a turn of a switch and market and stuff. So it should be kind of interesting. And I really want to hear is how he scaled to half a million lines of code of Perl. I think that's going to be a most important question for him. And we've got a bunch of other stuff all circling on the short list. In fact, like you said, Arduino, we actually have them on the short list, trying to get them in soon. A number of people have been contacting me, which is great, saying, somebody else said I'm on that list. Can you tell me why I'm on a list? So that's really great. So the project leaders are writing me saying, I think I need to talk to you, but I'm not sure why.
On the list, man. That's why you're on the list.
That's working really well. The list we're talking about, for those who this is your first show listening to it, twit.tv/floss, linked from there, you'll find the list of all the upcoming shows, including people I'm trying to schedule get on the list there. Also, again, over on my other podcast, on podcast.insightcruises.com, we just started the 3-part show by Ira Flato, recorded on the last Insight Cruise trip. And it's about why airplanes fly, and it's not the Bernoulli principle. Now, I don't know if you had time to listen to the first part yet, Leo, because it started giving it away already, but there it is. So go pick up that on that show. I know I had a huge bump and people coming from Floss Weekly, because I got email from people saying, I never heard about your other show. This is great. So podcast.insightcruises.com, find out why airplanes fly, and no, it's not the Bernoulli principle. So that's over in that show.
And we've set up a media wiki site for all of Twit. It's wiki.twit.tv. And you'll find very complete show notes going forward there, and maybe we can even go backwards as well, that are put together by our community. Thank you so much. Basically what I did is I pasted in our email that describes, you know, the projects and so forth, and people have already cleaned it up and added information. So it's going to be, I'm feeling it's going to be a really, really wonderful resource. And again, an open source project that is just paying off big time. So that's really
cool. And I'll be watching that daily too, and cleaning up anything that I see that's there. So I'm editing it as Randall Schwartz. It might make real obvious sense that I'm editing as myself. So seeing the edits by me, that's me. And so I'm watching that with all the shows too. So.
Wiki.twit.tv.
It's one more way that you're becoming the media mogul.
I just can't stop. I just can't stop. Randall, it's great to talk to you. Thank you for bringing us wonderful guests as always. We'll see you next time on Floss Weekly.